Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. Good afternoon. It's the show on 91.5 and KJZZ.org. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. In Valley traffic, watch out for a crash on the 60 eastbound at Stapley. Also on the 202 westbound Red Mountain Freeway, a crash at 32nd Street has the right lanes blocked. Slight chance we could see some rain this afternoon. Otherwise, look for partly cloudy skies with a high of 90. Chance of blowing dust as well as some storms tonight. Overnight lows in the lower 70s. Partly sunny tomorrow with a high of 94. It's partly sunny and 84 degrees right now at KJZZ. 121 vacant lots in South Phoenix will soon become new single-family homes. As KJZZ's Kerry Young reports, it's part of the city's larger South Phoenix Village infill project.
Much of the land for the project was purchased through the city's Blighted Structure Program over the last 10 years. It's the first infill project the city has launched since the last one finished construction before the housing crisis. Betty Ware is the president of the Broadway Heritage Neighborhood Association. She says the neighborhood played a significant role in planning.
And this is just the start of a many other directions that we want to go into. It was going to bring about a positive change. Positive change.
The city chose Affordable Housing Developer Foundation for Senior Living to construct the homes. They should be completed in 3 to 5 years. Kerry Young, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
In the past 20 years, Arizona's Latino population has doubled. According to the latest census figures, Hispanics make up 30% of our state's population. Recognizing the economic power behind those numbers is an ongoing goal of the Arizona Hispanic Chamber of Commerce. Today, the group released Datos 2016, its annual report on the local Hispanic market. KJZZ business correspondent Christina Estes has been looking over the numbers and discovered one big number has been revised downward. Christina, what's that about?
Well, we're talking about total Hispanic purchasing power in Arizona. It's estimated to top $42 billion this year. That's actually lower than earlier estimates of $50 billion. But because of the recession and a drop in immigration, particularly between Arizona and Mexico, that figure was revised to $42 billion. Still an impressive number, says Monica Villalobos. She's vice president of Arizona's Hispanic Chamber.
We know that the population is really hitting a plateau now, so we don't see as much increased growth in the population. In the past 5 years, it's remained pretty steady, but the spending power, the purchasing power, continues to go up exponentially. So for us, that indicates that Latinos are still spending, they're still contributing to the economy, even though it's leveling off a little bit.
But the chamber says the number will keep climbing. By 2019, it projects Latino buying power will top $49 billion in our state.
Christina, Datos covers a lot of ground as it presents consumer research on more than 2 million Hispanics in Arizona. What in those numbers stood out to you?
Well, I like learning the details on Latino spending power. For example, in 2014, Datos says Hispanics in Phoenix spent $1.3 billion on clothing and footwear. That's 26% of spending in that category. The report also finds Hispanics in Phoenix spend about 10% more on groceries every year compared to non-Hispanics. It even lists their top foods and stores. So I'm wondering, Mark, can you name one, a top food or top grocery store?
I don't know, maybe Fry's or Safeway, one of those?
Pretty good. The top grocery store listed, Fry's, Walmart, and Food City. And the most purchased foods, fresh meat, coffee, and tortillas.
Well, Christina, the report also looked at how Hispanics spend money on entertainment. What did it find there?
They are active casino visitors. Nearly 380,000 Hispanics in Phoenix reported visiting a casino in the past month. They also play slots more than non-Hispanics. They're also more likely to buy lottery tickets. And listen to this, 74% more likely to see a movie on opening weekend.
What about consumer behavior on the digital side?
Hispanics are considered efficient online shoppers. They search, download, and use online coupons at a higher rate than the general population. They use smartphones more often than non-Hispanics to look at things like menus or download restaurant apps. And it's that kind of information that Monica Villalobos with the Hispanic Chamber says business owners really need.
It helps guide their decisions about maybe what product extensions or what how to position their brand in the community, what media to use, what language they should be communicating in.
So, Christine, if you could sum up the sentiment from this year's conference, how would you describe that?
Well, more than once, I heard this. The Hispanic market is the mainstream market. And if businesses want to cash in, they need to buy into that thinking.
That's KJZZ's business correspondent, Christina Estes. Christina, thanks.
You're welcome.
Phoenix is hiring first responders. Both the police and fire departments are looking to add new recruits. And this morning, some city council members got an update on those efforts. Joining me with more on this is Councilman Michael Nowakowski, chairman of the Public Safety and Veterans Subcommittee, which got this morning's briefing. And Councilman Nowakowski, let's start with the police department. What did you learn about that?
Basically, we found out that there was about 299 officers that were available to hire this year, that we ended up with 295.
So what does that tell you about the overall, reaching that overall goal that the city has set?
You know what, I think we reached it pretty well. The standard is about 20% of the individuals that have met the academy drop out. So we're at the norm, having close to 300 available and hiring only 295.
How long do you think it will take until those officers are sort of integrated into the department and sent to the particular precincts where they'll be in and really on the job?
You know, we already have some of those officers out on the street already. So it looks like every month we're having a graduation class of anywhere from 14 to 20 police officers. So that's incredible for the city of Phoenix that we had this hiring freeze for such a long time, for about 7 years, and now we're having police officers out there on the street, brand new cops, so that's great.
One of the other things that you heard about this morning was about hiring efforts by the Phoenix Fire Department. Where do those stand right now?
So basically for this year, we actually have the total of 80 firefighters that are recruited and that are in training right now and scheduled to end their training this year. One of the good news that we received is that we actually got a SAFER grant. And basically what that means is that we're going to end up with 50 firefighter positions over the next 2 years. That's $9 million, and that means that we have no matching grants or funds that are required.
What do you think it means or will mean for Phoenix to have these additional first responders in uniform and available to be working?
You know, one of the things that we're seeing is that we have a lot of individuals that are retiring and that are hitting that retirement age. So we're right at that number of 1,650 firefighters. So by the time the individuals are retiring and the new recruits are coming on board, we'll be at that standard of 1,650 firefighters.
So you're basically just looking to sort of make up what you're losing as opposed to adding new people in that agency?
Correct, at this time. Uh-huh.
Is that the same for the police department as well?
You know, the police department, we're actually looking to add an extra 300 officers, and that's just going to basically break even to what we're losing in retirement.
I'm wondering if you heard anything from the police department folks about whether or not they've had difficulty or had more questions maybe from potential recruits, given sort of the dialogue going on now between police departments and communities across the country and some of the tensions, I guess, between law enforcement agencies and communities across the country.
You know, for a written exam, it's amazing that you can go to our convention center, and we have anywhere from 800 to over 1,000 people in the written exam. But basically, coming out of that written exam, we're only looking at a couple hundred individuals. So the recruits are there. It's just the quality and the standards that we have in the city of Phoenix is at a high level. We just want to make sure that we hire quality police officers that can patrol our streets and that are involved in our communities.
Phoenix Councilman Michael Nowakowski is chairman of the Public Safety and Veterans Subcommittee. Councilman Nowakowski, thanks.
Oh, thank you.
A controversial advocacy group responsible for more than 1,000 lawsuits against Arizona businesses has run into some trouble. The group Advocates for Individuals with Disabilities has aggressively sued businesses throughout the valley for allegedly violating the Americans with Disabilities Act. Frustration in the community eventually led to the Arizona Attorney General intervening in the cases. Late last week, a judge granted the state's request to consolidate many of the cases. KJZZ's Will Stone joins me to explain more. And Will, why did the AG step in? Was this unusual?
It is unusual, Mark, and as far as I can tell, somewhat unprecedented. But then again, what this group, Advocates for Individuals with Disabilities, or AID, is doing is somewhat unusual itself. The group, which was recently granted nonprofit status, has sued close to 2,000 business owners in Arizona, primarily for small violations of the Americans with Disabilities Act, the ADA. These are things like the height of a sign or the striping of an accessible space. And many of the businesses end up settling rather than fight the issue in court. And those settlements are confidential, but they often involve the parties who were sued paying thousands of dollars. This created so much frustration in the business community over the last couple months that the attorney general finally said, you know what, I think this group is actually abusing the judicial system. They're engaging in, quote, trolling tactics that are meant to essentially intimidate defendants into settling quickly for money. And so that led Brnovich recently to step in and ask that all the cases be consolidated and to allow him to essentially intervene in the case.
So what do we know about this group AID? How have they responded to all of this?
There's still a lot of unknowns about the group, Mark, because, as I said, they were only recently granted nonprofit status. What they've told me through my reporting is that they got their seed money for their organization from an anonymous donor, and that all the profits they receive from settlements go to fund gifts for people with disabilities, things like wheelchairs. And they pretty much say they're fighting for civil rights. And they point to the fact that many businesses, even after more than 25 years since the ADA was passed, are not compliant with the law. A caveat on that would be that many of the regulations they're suing about actually weren't implemented till 2010. But they've said that the attorney general is essentially on the wrong side of history, that what he's doing is, quote, despicable, is what one of the attorneys for the group has told me, and that he's siding with the lawbreakers.
Well, what are others saying about the AG's involvement?
Reaction has been mixed, Mark. Obviously, those in the business community who are being sued are very happy and supportive that Brnovich has finally gotten involved in this. They say you can't just file hundreds and hundreds of identical lawsuits and essentially what they say is force people into settling because they don't want to spend even more money to go to court. So they contend that this organization is really running a scam and that they're extorting the business community. Now, in the community of folks who advocate for those with disabilities in the Valley, I think there's a little more ambivalence. Generally, they concede that AID's created some bad will about the ADA. At the same time, there is some concern about the fact that Brnovich has intervened on behalf of the businesses who are ostensibly the people who may have violated the law. So I spoke with Attorney General Mark Brnovich about this just recently, and this is how he responded to that critique.
We take all of the allegations seriously, and when you have a bunch of frivolous lawsuits, I think it undermines the public's confidence in what is or isn't happening with the Disabilities Act.
Brnovich also says that the appropriate way to go about remedying violations of the ADA or Arizona's version of the ADA is to come to his office first, file a complaint, let the attorney general do his job, and then, you know, perhaps if nothing's been resolved, go into a lawsuit. But he said this group has not been doing that.
That's KJZZ's Will Stone. Thanks, Will.
Thanks, Mark.
It's the show on 91.5. Thanks for listening this afternoon. I'm Mark Brody, along with the takeaways, John Hockenberry today.
The role of NATO was a part of the candidate debate last night.
But when you look at NATO, I was asked on a major show, what do you think of NATO? And I have to understand, I'm a business person. I did really well, but I have common sense. And I said, well, I'll tell you. I haven't given lots of thought to NATO.
NATO, as a military alliance, has something called Article 5, and basically it says this: an attack on one is an attack on all. And do you know the only time it's ever been invoked? After 9/11.
Is the U.S. getting a raw deal from its NATO allies? Anders Fogh Rasmussen, Secretary General of NATO from 2009 until 2014, and before that, the Danish Prime Minister, says NATO has been unfairly bashed in the 2016 election. But he also believes that NATO allies need to restore U.S. power and leadership in the world, something that has been lost over the past 8 years. In a new book, The Will to Lead, America's Indispensable Role in the Global Fight for Freedom, Rasmussen says despite the Obama years' mistakes in the Middle East and elsewhere, the U.S. is still the world's 5,000-pound gorilla and has responsibilities whether we like it or not.
I wouldn't say that the United States hasn't made any mistakes, but you could also ask who else than the United States should act as what I call the world's policeman. We need clearly a policeman. When you have a look at Syria, Iraq, Libya, China flexing its muscles, the rogue state, North Korea, we need a policeman to restore law and order in the world, and I don't see any other than the United States. The United States is the only nation capable and credible as the world's policeman.
How important is this election, do you think?
I really do believe that's a crucial election for the world. After 8 years where the United States has demonstrated a reluctance to engage in the world, we need the next president to really take global leadership in leading the free democracies and counter autocracy and terrorists.
In terms of world leaders, Vladimir Putin, in your tenure as Secretary General of NATO, really pulled a fast one, it seems like. That he charmed George W. Bush and conveyed even to you, frankly, that you describe in your book, a sense of friendship and that Russia wants to be a part of this new world order. And then he seems to have really shafted all of you at the last minute. How do you feel about all that?
When I first met President Putin in May 2002 as new Prime Minister of Denmark, I saw a very pro-Western Russian president. So I left that summit very optimistic. Then suddenly things changed. And from 2005, we saw a very negative President Putin. He's been worse ever since. And you might ask why. And I see two reasons. One was the Rose Revolution in Georgia in 2003. The next was the Orange Revolution in Ukraine in 2004. President Putin was strongly convinced that the Americans in general and CIA in particular were behind those colored revolutions and that the aim was to spread that to Moscow. And since then, he has been increasingly anti-Western. So he is an embodiment that when the United States retreats or even is perceived to retreat, the United States will leave behind a vacuum, and that vacuum will be filled by the bad guys.
There's a lot of skepticism about the United States right now. If you go to Estonia or Latvia, there's a certain sort of musing about whether the U.S. would actually defend a Russian invasion of the Baltic states. If there's that doubt, how does the U.S. prevent one of these places from basically changing the map of the world?
That's a very good question. And I think one of the most damaging statements from the current administration is the statement that was presented by an anonymous source that the U.S. was leading from behind. I've never heard the president nor his secretaries use that expression, but nevertheless, it was stated that the U.S. would only lead from behind, which of course is, that's ridiculous. You cannot lead from behind. You'll have to lead from the front. And furthermore, one of the presidential candidates, Mr. Trump, has raised doubts about collective defense within NATO because he has stated that he would make that defense dependent on the country's contributions.
Well, he said NATO is obsolete. He said it's obsolete.
Yeah, so all that together has raised doubts about the U.S. commitment to defending its allies. So all in all, we need the next president to really demonstrate, like President Kennedy once did when in his inaugural he stated that the U.S. will pay any price, bear any burden to defend friends and promote liberty.
Anders Fogh Rasmussen, thank you so much for being with us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Anders Fogh Rasmussen served as Secretary General of NATO from 2009 till 2014. He's the author of The Will to Lead, America's Indispensable Role in the Global Fight for Freedom.
And that's John Hockenberry at The Takeaway. As students are settling into their routines this school year, there's a new effort in Tucson to help students who aren't doing their learning in the classroom but in a hospital room. Banner Health is working with the U of A College of Education on a hospital school program at a children's hospital in Tucson. To find out more about it, I'm joined by Cara Snyder, Director of Pediatric Nursing at Diamond Children's Medical Center at Banner University Medical Center in Tucson. And Cara, this sounds kind of like a tutoring program for kids who are stuck in the hospital.
Yes, and so much more. The hospital school program came out of our acknowledgement of the need to really treat the whole child, and school is a normal part of childhood, and when these kids are in the fight of their life, they were not able to have that sense of normalcy. So we said we need to do something about this and derived this hospital school program at Diamond Children's.
So tell me how it works. Do you have teachers coming into hospitals to work with individual kids?
Yeah, and this summer we hired a teacher. She's our education specialist for the hospital school program, and her role is to work with our clinical team to identify children who may have some challenging needs or may be coming into a new medical diagnosis where education challenges may be anticipated. And she is working with the children directly. She's coordinating volunteers within our system to help provide instruction. She's connecting with the school districts all over southeastern Arizona to ensure that the districts are aware of what some of the challenges the child may be experiencing, some of the resources they may be needed from a learning standpoint. And she's staying in constant contact with the children's teachers.
Have you found that teachers and their schools are generally receptive and able to provide materials and get worksheets or lessons to the students and to the teachers who come into the hospital so that the students can sort of keep up with what their classmates are doing at school?
Sure. We have seen such positive response of the teachers and the districts to have this kind of resource. You know, before we launched this program, our ability to bring children back into the classroom wasn't as coordinated by somebody who's an expert in education. It was really shepherded by the parents, by the student services within the school. And this role has brought about a whole new way of transition back into the classroom. So not only is our education specialist able to bring those learning lessons and such into the hospital, she's also able to help prepare the districts and the teachers with what challenges that child may be experiencing as they come into the classroom again, or maybe as they continue into their learning environment.
I would think that for a lot of kids going into the hospital, and probably their parents as well, the first thing they're feeling is fear. They're afraid of what's going to happen. They're nervous about treatment or what the possible outcome might be. I would think that schoolwork and completing schoolwork and staying current on schoolwork might not be on the top of their minds at that time.
Well, you'd think, right? Because, of course, we see it through the lenses and eyes of an adult. But children, no matter what they're dealing with, often just want to feel like normal kids. And being a normal kid is about going to school and learning and being on pace with their peers.
Is this program based on something that is being done elsewhere? I mean, did you sort of come up with this on your own, or are there other areas or other schools that are trying something similar?
Well, a hospital school program is not unique to Diamond Children's. There's hospital school programs all over the country in children's hospitals and medical centers. Our program is unique in its collaboration with the university.
Cara Snyder is Director of Pediatric Nursing at Diamond Children's Medical Center at Banner University Medical Center in Tucson. When you were a kid, it was probably either the best or worst time of the day, silent reading, when the teacher told the whole class you had 15 minutes to read on your own and no talking. Well, it's back, and this time it's for adults. We'll let the show's Annika Klein pick up the story from here.
This does not sound like a room of 50 people, but the event space at Changing Hands Bookstore in Phoenix is packed. And everyone is immersed in another world, which is why there isn't a peep, just the occasional page turning.
It's the first time we've done this, and the concept is really simple.
That's Lauren Pugh. She organized the event, which somehow manages to be both social and individualistic at the same time.
It's just people coming together to read whatever they'd like silently for about an hour. And afterwards, if they'd like to stay and chat, they can meet new friends. Otherwise, they're just kind of reading in companionable silence.
Silent reading parties like this one started showing up in places like New York and Seattle a few years ago, in hotels, bars, bookstores, and they're now beginning a new chapter in Phoenix. But let's be real, a silent party sounds kind of like an oxymoron. So why do people come to them?
There are so many opportunities for people these days. There are so many things you could be doing or learning. And so sometimes people just are too tired or just don't take the time to read. And at home, you've got Netflix, you've got your bed. So here it's saying, like, set aside this time to come out and do this thing.
That's exactly what Demetra Presley needed.
I am reading The Bookstore. It's a guilty pleasure of mine. It's chick lit fiction.
She says she loves reading, but she's all too familiar with dog ears that never get lifted again because life gets in the way.
You get in your day and you have a bunch of different things happening. You get home and you're tired and you just want to go to bed. So for this, it's on my calendar. It's part of my schedule. This is where I'm going to go. And I'm going to sit and I'm going to read. You know, it just made it official.
At first, Presley tried to sign up for a different silent reading party in Phoenix, happening later this week at a hotel.
And I went back to get a ticket. I think maybe a couple days later, and it was completely booked.
Changing Hands hosts a more conventional book club where everyone reads the same book and discusses it. It brings in about 80 to 100 people a month. But these silent reading events are helpful for people who can't quite commit to getting all those pages in. There's no homework for this one.
I'm reading The Da Vinci Code, actually, by Dan Brown.
That's Jason Wilson. He's just a few pages into the best-selling thriller. Wilson sees silent reading parties as part of a larger trend to get people off their screens and back to the basics.
I think people are kind of seeking that excuse to go out and like really kind of go back into like the roots of things, you know, whether it be like the mom and pop stores. So I feel like there's something to be said about, you know, having paper in hand.
Wilson's here with his wife and a few friends enjoying drinks from the bar. But I ask him, would he make this a habit on his own? Come to a store or coffee shop just to read?
I don't know. But I enjoy the idea of everyone coming together for that same purpose.
No matter what page you start on. It's the show. I'm Annika Klein.
In a check of international news on KJZZ, some say it marks a new era in medicine, the birth of a baby boy created using DNA from three people. The boy's Jordanian mom and dad had been trying to start a family for nearly two decades, but suffered fertility problems and a series of miscarriages, as the BBC's James Gallagher explains.
The Jordanian parents had faced repeated heartache before the birth of this healthy boy. Two of their children died and they have had four miscarriages. Each of their losses was down to faulty mitochondria, the tiny structures in our bodies that convert food into usable energy. Mitochondria are passed on only through the mother's egg, so the team at the New Hope Fertility Center in New York took DNA from the mother, put it into a healthy donor egg, and then fertilized it with the father's sperm. Dr. John Zhang conducted the advanced form of IVF.
In this way, we can reduce the defected structure in her egg so she can have a healthy baby but still using her own DNA but borrow the material from the donor.
However, the baby has 0.1% of its DNA from the donor woman. Creating so-called three-person babies permanently changes human genetic inheritance. It is controversial and has provoked ethical and religious objections. As a result, the procedure is either illegal or closely regulated around the world. The US doctors had to cross the border to Mexico, where it's less stringently regulated. Dr. Dagan Wells from the University of Oxford tested the embryos before they were implanted. He says this is a huge moment.
I'm very excited by this. I think it's something that so many scientists have been working towards for such a long time, and to see it finally coming to fruition is enormously encouraging.
This development has come out of the blue. Researchers at the University of Newcastle have led the world in this procedure. They welcome the birth, but criticise the lack of information about precisely how the technique was performed and how the child will be monitored to ensure they stay healthy. Other doctors have questioned whether we are only now hearing the success story, while failed attempts could have gone unreported. The New York team insists they will answer all these questions when they present their data at the American Society for Reproductive Medicine's annual conference next month.
That's the BBC's James Gallagher.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the talk about border security this election season has centered on an enormous wall proposed by Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump. But now we'll hear about a quiet effort by U.S. prosecutors to target lookouts scouting inside the U.S. for Border Patrol agents. From KJZZ's Fronteras desk, Michel Morisco reports on an operation designed to find these lookouts before they spot the agents.
There's no visible trail along this hard slope scrabbled out of granite and sharp edges that slice. Boulders perch on smaller rocks and look as if they haven't been disturbed in a millennium until they slide crashing down the mountain. The West Desert is among the most haunting and unforgiving of regions in Arizona. The nearest highway is State Route 85, running from Ajo down to Mexico, a faint band quivering in the sun. And perhaps because of that desolation, someone has been perched here 1,000 feet high in the mountains, watching the movement of federal agents roaming the desert below.
Socks, some of the trash, the lids, the Tabasco, you know, some of the hot sauce, pots and pans they used to cook.
This man is called Agent Paul, a tracker with the U.S. Border Patrol's Operation Waypoint, a mountain scout interdiction team based in Ajo.
Here's some carpet booties. They use this to mask their foot sign when they cross, you know, when they cross the open expanses in the soft terrain.
This campsite is only about halfway up the mountain. The agent continues upwards now through black lava and slippery quartz. It's a favorite place for what agents call spotters, the popular slang from these scouts in Mexico, halcones, falcons.
Right there's Montezuma's Head, there's the Ajo Range. There's nothing you really can't see here.
For years, Agent Paul and the Border Patrol's Tucson sector were plagued by these mountain scouts, radioing down agents' positions to their envoys moving people and dope across the border, as quick and elusive as their bird of prey namesake. But then one day in November 2014, Agent Paul got a break when he spotted a pair of heads shifting on a mountaintop.
So we talked to the pilot, and the pilot was like, yeah, I'll try to see. I said, there's probably not a place to land. I said, you might just be able to put one skid down and us jump out.
The pilot landed one chopper skid on a boulder, and Agent Paul and his partner stepped off onto the mountain. They caught two men.
There was like a little cave real close to me, and I started looking through the cave. There was a lot of trash. And I found a pair of binos, found, I think, a couple phones, some solar panels. I think there was one or two radios.
One of the men he arrested was Abelardo Niebla Torres. Agent Vicente Paco had encountered Niebla Torres 2 years before.
What they were doing is they were dropping them off along with supplies and along with other individuals to scout this location.
Prosecutors were able to tie that previous case to this one, and they used it to prove Niebla Torres was scouting out safe passage for drug traffickers.
There wasn't a coincidence that he was in a mountaintop. You know, it was a prior arrest showed that he was doing the similar things.
He testified about that previous arrest in court.
He was arrested in the same circumstances. He was arrested with gear that was used at the time and now. For scouting activity, he was arrested with supplies. He was arrested with solar panels. He was arrested with sleeping bags.
Since then, prosecutors have brought cases against about 80 of these scouts in the Tucson sector. Niebla Torres was found guilty of conspiracy last year. Rosemarie Valdez represented him in court.
The government is basically prosecuting these individuals that are found in caves or on mountaintops because of what they allege is scouting equipment. Despite the lack of evidence that they're actually part of a conspiracy.
She filed an appeal, and that's currently being heard in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. Back up on that mountaintop, Agent Paul is readying for what he anticipates will be more scouts. Maybe the one who left this frying pan behind. The marijuana harvest season starts in October in Mexico. And after his arrest of Niebla Torres, he's optimistic.
If you can take away the scout, You've basically leveled the playing field.
Michel Marisco, KJZZ News, the West Desert.
When you think about photos you've seen of the national parks, a few names come to mind. But one of those names is probably not George Grant.
Grant was a staff photographer with the National Park Service. He worked for the agency from 1929 to 54 and took a lot of pictures of different parks across the country. Some of them are featured in the September issue of Arizona Highways magazine. And joining me with more on George Grant and his work are Wren and Helen Davis. They wrote Landscapes for the People, George Alexander Grant, first chief photographer of the National Park Service. And Helen, given your backgrounds, you're a retired elementary school teacher. Wren is a retired hospital executive. How did you get interested in writing about this photographer that many people have probably never heard of?
Well, we were introduced to George Grant in 2006. We were in the National Park Service Historic Photographic Collection at Charlestown, West Virginia. We were working with the archivist to see photographs of men working in the Civilian Conservation Corps. And one of the photographs was men of the CCC in the foreground with Jackson Lake of the Grand Teton National Park behind them. And I thought it was an Ansel Adams image and got so excited, pointed it out to Wren, and when we turned the photograph over, we discovered it was done by George Grant. And after seeing several more photographs credited to George Grant, we asked Tom Durant, the archivist, who was George Grant, and he told us he was the first chief photographer of the National Park Service. And we said, why have we never heard his name? And it was explained that because he was a staff member of the National Park Service, the credit was always National Park Service. Very infrequently did George Grant receive personal credit.
Wren, why was it important to you to bring George Grant himself and his work to light?
I think in many ways, when we saw the photographs, we recognized a number of them and realized that these images had been seen by millions of people throughout the years in magazines and newspapers and park publications and museum exhibits. But this gentleman who produced these beautiful images had never received any credit for his work. So we felt like this was what we call an unknown elder in the field of American landscape photography, someone who was a very gifted photographer, but was really in the shadow of many of his contemporaries, such as Ansel Adams and Elliot Porter and people of that nature.
So you mentioned that part of the reason that he didn't get a lot of credit or notoriety was because the Park Service itself owned the images. He was a staffer at the National Park Service. Did he have a particular mission in that job to photograph certain images or photograph certain things in certain ways?
He was given many assignments, but one of the most important aspects was to show Americans or people enjoying our beautiful national parks. A lot of his images are just pure landscapes, but so many are people, whether they're hiking or horseback riding or just sitting beside a campsite, they are enjoying our magnificent national parks.
I mean, he was a very versatile photographer. He was, in many ways, an assignment photographer who could produce whatever the Park Service needed. It might be, as Helen described, landscape images or especially everyday people enjoying the parks, but he could also do very good portrait work of significant individuals in the Park Service. He did a lot of technical photography, museum artifacts and exhibits, construction projects. So he really was able to produce images of all different kinds for the Park Service.
Helen, you mentioned that the first image of his you saw you thought was an Ansel Adams photo. You know, I think a lot of people are used to seeing Ansel Adams, sort of have a sense of what they look like. How do George Grant's images compare to those from someone like an Ansel Adams?
I think it's the composition of his photographs and the fact that they're clear from corner to corner with such different levels of contrast in his beautiful black and white images that just made me think, as many people do, of Ansel Adams and the national parks.
I mean, one thing I think that differentiates Grant was he was shooting in pretty significant quantity. He was shooting dozens and dozens of images for the Park Service of a particular subject, different angles. And much of his work was what you might describe as straight photography. Ansel Adams was doing a lot of fine art photography, different angles, dramatic images. George's was more capturing what the eye saw and producing images that would be valuable for park publications and things of that nature to capture what the tourist might see.
When you guys look at Grant's photographs, what do they tell you about those places in those times?
I think there are two things for me. The one is that he helped Congress see how important it was to preserve several areas that have become national parks for us. But also he preserved the way the parks were so that when we see his photographs today, we often want to go and see that same place and see how it has been preserved for generations to come, but also some of the changes that have occurred.
I think, too, that when we look at his photographs, we think of them within the context of the era within which he worked, which was principally in the 1930s. And we're talking about the Roosevelt administration, the New Deal. In 1933, of course, Roosevelt signed the bill that created the Civilian Conservation Corps, and then a short time later, he issued an executive order that brought into the National Park Service many of the national monuments and many of the national battlefields and historic sites of that kind, literally doubling the size of the National Park Service. So a lot of George Grant and his associates' work was documenting these new units of the Park Service and at the same time looking at proposed and planned national parks. He traveled to Great Smoky Mountains. He traveled to the Natchez Trace Parkway. He traveled to a number of other locations that were being considered for national parks.
It sounds like in some ways Grant was taking photographs of places that most Americans had never seen before.
I think there's a lot of truth to that. If you think back in the 1920s, nearly all of the national parks were in the West, but most Americans lived in the East, and as a result, due to the cost and the time to visit national parks, most Americans really had no opportunity to visit the remote Western parks. So there was a strong incentive to develop eastern parks and create national park units closer to the population areas. And then also as transportation improved, everyday Americans could travel by automobile to many of these parks. So yes, it was really an era of truly making the national parks national in the truest sense of the word.
Wren and Helen Davis are the authors of Landscapes for the People, George Alexander Grant, First Chief Photographer of the National Park Service. A number of Grant's photographs are featured in the September issue of Arizona Highways Magazine. Conservationists from all over the world are gathering in South Africa this week for a Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species meeting. It's held every 3 years, and representatives from 182 nations meet to agree to laws and regulations to protect rare animals and plants. African elephants have been particularly badly hit by poaching in recent years. Trade in rhino horn will also be discussed, as will pangolins, as the BBC's Alistair Leithhead reports.
How long is the tongue?
The tongue is as long as the body up to the tail.
Scuffling around in the dirt is a young pangolin, the world's most trafficked mammal. But being shy and nocturnal, certainly not its most well-known. So, what's it like? Think of an anteater that looks like a pine cone, or an artichoke. Or maybe an armadillo, but stretched and a bit more lizard-like. Lisa Highwood is the founder of a sanctuary for them in Zimbabwe.
Culturally, they've been revered throughout Africa.
Pangolins only eat ants and termites, and when threatened, roll up in a ball. But they're used in traditional medicine.
The scales are ground up in powder. With the Asians, they use the scales in a multiple range of purposes, from cancer to swelling to arthritis.
Video footage from Vietnam shows piles of dead pangolins rolled up and wrapped in nets. Now the Asian species are almost extinct. Demand for African pangolins has increased. It's the kind of trafficking the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species of Wild Fauna and Flora, or CITES, was set up to stop. Over the next 10 days, among other things, delegates will decide whether all pangolins should be moved to the highest level of protection. Elephants are also being discussed. Africa has lost 30% in 7 years, but tackling this problem is much more controversial. Zimbabwe opened up its ivory store to show us its well-stacked and ordered tusks. It and Namibia have huge stockpiles and would like to sell them to raise money for conservation. They're proposing that restrictions be lifted so they can sell the ivory, but other countries strongly disagree.
Kenya have put in a proposal to put the elephants on Appendix 1 of CITES, which would mean a total ban in the trade of ivory from elephants.
Kitili Mbathi is Director General of Kenya Wildlife Service.
Previous concessions allowing the sales of ivory from some of our southern African brothers has resulted in an increased demand for ivory across the board.
But veteran conservationist Mike Norton Griffiths strongly disagrees.
If you keep removing the value of elephant by stopping the ivory trade, I think things are continue to get worse. Everybody wants the same thing. In Africa, we want lots of elephants and lots of ivory. In Asia, they want lots of elephants and lots of ivory. And if the Asians will invest hundreds of millions of dollars in infrastructure development in Africa, they will surely invest in elephant conservation and ivory production so long as they are insured of a stable, legal, and transparent supply.
Rhinos are also being targeted. Their horns are worth more than twice their weight in gold on the black market. So Zimbabwean rangers are cutting them off in the hope that will deter poachers who killed 1,300 in Africa last year. Swaziland's proposal to open up sales of rhino horn is unlikely to pass, as most countries believe the best way to save the animals is to stop trade and destroy the market in countries like China and Vietnam. But finding consensus is always the challenge.
That's the BBC's Alistair Leithhead. This week, Ballet Arizona continues its tradition of presenting outdoor free performances around the valley, what they call Ballet Under the Stars. The show's Naomi Gingold reports.
Hi! Be with you in just a moment.
Okay, great.
My name is Samantha Turner. I'm Executive Director of Ballet Arizona.
Can you tell me about what's going on? You've got an event this weekend, and what is it and how did it start?
Sure. We are beginning the 19th season of our Ballet Under the Stars presentations, free ballet in 5 Valley Metro locations. Coming up, we'll be doing Tempe Center for the Performing Arts Amphitheater outside at Tempe Town Lake on Thursday, and then we will finish up with Sun City West on Friday evening.
And what does that mean? You just go like into a park at Sun City West and you're like, I'm just going to construct a stage here?
Well, it's not quite as simple as that. You know, we work with and negotiate with the community a year in advance and make plans for this. Then we do. We show up at 8 o'clock in the morning and we have a crew of probably 10 or 12 who take things off of a big semi-truck, bring it out there to the park and begin to construct a stage where there was just grass before.
Usually ballet is like something that's expensive that people go to, and it's not like the most accessible thing. I don't exactly think that regular people are like, I'm going to go to the ballet.
You know, that is true. Some people feel that it's something that, you know, only certain people could experience and enjoy, but it's really not the case. Whenever I see a newcomer come experience ballet, they just, the music and the movement, they're in awe, and they just really connect with it. So we do Ballet Under the Stars for free so people can give it a try and see what they think and without taking any risk of spending any money.
And what are you guys going to be performing?
We have a really interesting and exciting mix for this. 3 different ballets. One is a classic story ballet called La Bayadere, which is the story of a warrior and a lowly temple dancer and a vengeful Raja's daughter. So it's a love triangle with all sorts of fantastic costumes. We follow that with a new choreography. It's called Paco Pepe Pluto. And it's 3 male solos to some Rat Pack music with Dean Martin and Joe Scalise. And then we follow that with Symphony in 3 Movements, which is from the great ballet master George Balanchine. He is the father of the American ballet style, a very intense, ballet that includes music by Igor Stravinsky. It's a really fast-paced, fast-moving ballet. And then within all that, we squeeze in class act and a few giveaways for free tickets and some other things during the performance.
So it's going to be a bunch of professional dancers and then kids from the local school doing their dances?
Yes, part of the Ballet Under the Stars program is an outreach program to children in the local schools. And our dancers will go to a school and teach them about ballet and dance and then help the students choreograph their own 2 to 3 minute production, which they then present on stage during the Ballet Under the Stars program. Frankly, it probably gets the most applause of all of the things that happen on stage that night. I'll just say that the dancers really enjoy doing Ballet Under the Stars because they love to be that connected to the crowd. Performing ballet in the theater, you know, there's a lot of space between you and the audience. That's not the case at Ballet Under the Stars. And you'll also see all sorts of little children who dance around during the performance. It's really a wonderful experience for the dancers and the ballet staff as much as it is for the audience.
Great. Well, thank you. Thank you so much. I really appreciate this.
Thank you.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.